You're listening to Let's Talk, episode 12. Howdy all and welcome to Let's Talk. Father Corey Stika here again this week, where we talk about issues of interest to our community. A couple of panelists with us today. First of all, we got Sarah Vabulous in Georgia. How you doing, Sarah?
Good morning, Father Corey. Thanks for having me on.
Glad to have you. We're trying to squeeze this in before a tech support call that she's got coming. So thanks for fitting us in your schedule.
And stop it. I'm not that busy. I just made an error in scheduling.
Nah, not a big deal. And we got Shelly Kelly in Texas. How are you doing?
Howdy, Father. We're doing great down here.
Good. How's nice and hot down there? I suppose for both of you, it's nice and hot.
Well, I work in an air-conditioned office, so it's a regular 72 degrees in there.
That's a good thing.
You act like I go outside.
Yeah, I know, right?
They tell me it's hot outside, but...
Well, you know, I'm in Montana where hot means it's above, about 80 or so.
Oh, well, we have 93% humidity currently, so come on down.
Oh, no, thank you. Been there, done that. Don't ever want to go to that again.
I think the 100-degree mark, I think we're below it again, so that's good.
Well, you know, since we've restarted Let's Talk, neither of you have been on, so I'll give you opportunity to introduce yourself. So, Shelly, why don't you just give a little introduction about yourself and let people know who you are.
Okay, my name is Shelly Kelly, and that's not my mother's fault. That's my husband's, because he was too darn charming and wooed me. And I am a cradle Catholic, grew up in the late 70s, early 80s. I'm the oldest of three siblings, so there's three of us. Educated, married, three kids myself. I have two teenagers, one in college, one in high school. And then I have my 40th birthday surprise, who is 6 and a half now. And I changed careers about 6 years ago. Yes, with a newborn. I changed careers at the same time. And now I work for a technology company, telecommunications company. And my previous iteration, I was an archivist and worked with historical documents. And I've been involved with SQPN off and on and on various podcasts since 2009.
Excellent. Excellent. Glad to have you. Glad to have you on the podcast, and hopefully we'll see you plenty of times. And Sarah, how about you tell people about yourself?
Oh, yeah. So I'm Sarah Vabulous. I live in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm an Atlanta native. We are a rare thing, so always fun. I went to school at St. Mary's College at the University of Notre Dame, go Irish, and have worked in some sort of media technology since I graduated. What year is it? 12 years ago, over 12 years ago at this point. So that's pretty cool. And now I work for a software company, one of the biggest in the world, as a matter of fact, and I fly around the country helping people. I run in the Catholic world a blog called Catholic Drinky that I never update, but I did write a book a couple years ago, so that was really fun. And I'm also co-host of the Catholic Hipster podcast with Tommy Tai, the Catholic Hipster. And that's just it. You know, I keep pretty busy and just love spending time with my folks on SQPN. Got involved in about 2009, 2010, and just enjoyed the ride.
Well, very good. Of course,
Sarah.
Of course, Kath and I are both Catholic Weekend alum.
Oh, yeah.
So that was
my sister's going to kill me. I didn't make the plug for our blog.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
That's how we got involved with SQPN. My sister and I, we blog it of Sound Mind and Spirit. And while the blog itself hasn't been very active lately, we do keep up the Facebook page. So if you want to see us, check us out at Facebook, Sound Mind and Spirit.
Well, Isn't it so much easier just to update like Twitter, Instagram, Facebook versus doing an actual blog?
You mean actually having to write something and then edit it and make it sound nice? Yes.
Yes.
Well, hopefully we do that when we post on Facebook, but yeah, sure.
Well, right now it's a lot of travel videos because we went to St. Francis Cabrini's shrine in Golden, Colorado. And so I've got little videos of climbing the mountain there.
That's a beautiful spot. So it was cool. Just there about a year or so ago. That was phenomenal. And actually, this is a good good transition to our first topic, because we're going to talk about social media. There is a YouTube video. If you haven't seen it, we'll have a link to it in our show notes. But it's kind of making the rounds right now, where it, a gentleman by the name of Jaron Lanier. Jaron, J-A-R-O-N. That's kind of a, he's got kind of an interesting name. Jaron Zeppel Lanier is his full name. His parents must have had some very interesting decisions when they were choosing names. But he's a tech guy from way back. He actually worked for Atari back at the time when Atari was at its height. He's really one of the forefathers, if you will, of the virtual reality movement. He really developed virtual reality goggles, gloves back in the, you know, again in 85, 90, when it was just really getting started. It was still a very primitive technology. He's done a lot of, you know, just looking at his list of stuff that he's done as on Wikipedia, he's very much been involved in new technologies and updating technologies and developing technologies. So he's not someone who is kind of a fly by night. All of a sudden I'm going to start talking about technological issues. He knows technology. And in this YouTube video, he expresses some real concerns about social media as it exists today. And the one thing I like about this video, first of all, is that he's not an extremist of all social media is bad. The idea of social media, he is very supportive of. What he is mostly opposed to is how social media, especially the big ones, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, how things like that are run. That's where his concern comes in. And basically, to kind of sum up this 20-minute interview, which is very much worth watching, his big concern is that we have delegated so much of the oversight of these media to computer algorithms, to advertisers, to money, you know. So it's more like, for example, if you get a strike on YouTube, you know, you post something, you get a strike. There wasn't somebody who actually sat down and watched that video and said, oh, you copyright, you'd use this copyright material. There's an algorithm that runs on YouTube in the background that looks at your video. Oh, this part matches this video, therefore you get a strike. And I think, and that's a big part of his concern, at least as I saw the video, that these social media are being done by robots, basically. You know, and it's really, instead of allowing us to communicate, it's actually hindering our communication. And you mentioned one area of concern, Shelley, as we were talking before, was that because of what these bots allow us to see, they affect our reactions. You know, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that.
No, so I didn't watch all of the video. I'll just put that out there right now. And I started watching a little bit at work, so it was hard to keep picking it back up there.
But don't worry about it, boss. It's cool. Don't worry.
Yeah. The boss always walks in exactly when you start something that you're really not supposed to be looking at.
Exactly.
But that idea that we're being controlled by the algorithms and by the computers, and I'd never really put a lot of thought into that somebody is manipulating it, and I don't like that idea. But I understand that there's math and technology involved in trying to use the algorithms to capture what you're looking at, what you're interested in, and then showing you more of that. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons I don't always believe it is because it doesn't always show me everything I want to see. It shows me a lot of opposing viewpoints, or which I do want to see, I should say. I mean, I don't want to be only fed one perspective or one way of looking at life or the world. But I thought that was really interesting, that the idea that they're somehow controlling what you see and how you think.
Well, it's one thing. Common example I always kind of use where you can see this in action is go on YouTube and watch just one video. just, you know, go watch, you know, oh, hey, here, you know, here's a video of, you know, police chases on dash cam or something like that, you know, and all of a sudden your recommendation feed is full of police chases and dash cam views and accident videos. And never mind the science fiction TV shows you've been watching, you know, things on about, you know, on YouTube, those all disappear. Now it's everything of this one video you watched.
I had not noticed that. I noticed the ads, of course, because I could be at work and I could Google, you know, I don't know, a whiteboard. And all of a sudden I'll go to Facebook and or the ads on the side, or I'll go to Google for something else, or Amazon or any other website, any other news website. And all of a sudden, every ad that they want to run and across the screen is about whiteboards. But right. I understood that.
Right.
So
it happens on Pinterest, too. Last night I was looking things up about Disney, because I'm going to go to Disney World later this year, and I want to personalize my Magic Band. And so all I did was get on Pinterest super quick to look and see where I could find a Mary Poppins Magic Band, because they're my she's my fave. I love her. But now everything on Pinterest for me is all about Disney and like visiting Disney World. I'm like, I did one search.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, and it's Jaron's point with that is that, and it's not malicious. You know, I think that's one thing I really like about this video is he's giving the developers the benefit of the doubt. He's giving Facebook, Twitter, and so on the benefit of the doubt that they did not set up these algorithms this way on purpose. Mm-hmm. But it is a result of human nature versus a computer. And what he says is, I think we understand this, that our emotions, you know, something that upsets us is we react instantly, quickly. You know, if someone says or does something, we have that flash of anger.
That knee-jerk reaction.
But something that makes us happy, that we enjoy, it's not a flash. We don't have a flash of laughter usually. We build up to it. You know, it's a slow reaction. Well, of course, these algorithms are watching our responses virtually in real time, and they're doing it very quickly, you know, milliseconds after we do something, they're developing a response to what we've done. And so our negative emotions are the ones that they react to quicker than our positive emotions, because it takes longer for those positive emotions to build up. And that's, in his opinion, that's why these algorithms do tend towards the things that set us off more than the things that make us happy. You know, the positive responses.
I mean, I don't know if you guys know this, but I quit Facebook about 2 years ago, and it's been great. Legit never been happier since I quit Facebook.
Yeah.
Well, see, and one of the things being on Facebook, I've had to learn to do, and when Facebook first came out, it was exciting, and it changed friendships, though. It really changed the way you interacted with people. Right. Because I had personal work friends, and work friends who became personal friends, and I had personal friends, and I had school friends, and I had family. Mm-hmm. And when you started Facebook, you know, you get excited. You're like, oh, I know them. And you start adding him and adding him and adding him. But suddenly you're being yourself. You're not filtering the way you would filter if I was in a professional work conference. Maybe I wouldn't talk about an election. But if I'm talking with family, of course we're going to talk. We're going to do what we do. We're going to debate it and talk about it. And it's not personal. It's how we interact. Mm-hmm. So suddenly my professional work friends are seeing how I interact with family. And so you've, again, the whole spectrum. And I lost a lot of friends because I gained some, I lost some.
Yeah.
But nowadays, what I've come to understand on Facebook especially is, you know what, if they're posting their opinion on their board, I don't have to like it. I don't have to comment on it. I don't have to, I like the person. And I remind myself when I get all hot, oh, how can they think that? Wait a minute. That's what they think. Accept them. Scroll on.
Right. Except for you're the exception to the rule.
That's what I find out.
Like that's the, and I think that right there is the crux, is how we react to when people have a different opinion than us. I'm not sure. I wasn't alive. I didn't experience what it was like before really, I mean, I remember as a kid before social media, et cetera, but not as a voting adult mm-hmm. or as an adult with opinions. I didn't experience what the world was like, especially if you think back on to what life was like in the 50s, the 60s, in the workplace and whatnot. Like, did people talk about those things? Did, because the 60s in particular, very hot button issues going mm-hmm. on in politics, like the country was very torn in a number of ways, both culturally as well right. as with the war in mm-hmm. Vietnam, et cetera. Like, did people just not talk about it and they just decided, oh, hey, we're all going to get along if in the workplace or how does this work or even among friends? Like, hey, we were friends as kids and we've stayed friends, but now we're on opposite sides. So do we have to be mortal enemies? Because that's how I feel it is now. Like, you find yeah. out someone you've been friends with forever. Oh, my gosh. Like, you hate the person that I voted for and I love them. Like,
right.
We can't be friends. Which I yeah. think is silly. I think it's silly.
I think that's a change. I think, well, honestly, social media has made us more reactive, like you are saying, mm-hmm. Father, that we're more reactive to being divisive. Because I do remember before social media, and I didn't even have cable television until probably when I got married, and that was in the late 90s, right? Mm-hmm. So I did not grow up in a house with cable television. We watched whatever six channels were on the maybe more. It was Houston. So we had all those, you know, lower or higher band channels, whatever it is. Yep. But I remember reading the newspapers cover to cover. The newspapers were fascinating. I remember we used to watch the local news and we'd watch sometimes the national evening news. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember talking much about politics, especially in high school. And you did not talk politics when you were at the office. And I know people talk about water cooler talk. I never remember anyone talking about a lot of divisive issues in the office. But I know we talked about it, especially in our families and in our close circle right. of friends, because that's how you kept ideas. And it was more of a debate. It was okay to disagree. Mm-hmm. It was, well, I think this. Well, I think that. Well, why do you think that? Well, here's why. Oh, well, that's a good point, but I don't agree with you on that. Okay, well, you make a good point, but I'm never going to agree with you on that. Okay, hey, you want to go get tacos? Okay, let's go get tacos.
Yeah, exactly.
And today it's like, it's all or nothing. It's like, well, if you can't agree with me, we can't be friends. I was like, why? Right. We've been friends for 30 years.
Yeah.
The scene from John Wayne's The Quiet Man, where if you know, old movie, I can't remember when it came out, and I think the 50s, or it's, you know, classic movie. It's a fun movie. And you've got the, you know, John Wayne and this other guy who John Wayne's interested in his sister. And the guy hates him. Guy absolutely hates him. Well, there's a scene where they duke it out. I mean, it's an all out battle royale. They're busting through windows. They're, you know. After the fight, they're the best of friends. You know, we don't get to that point mm-hmm. now. And, you know, I just, you know, in thinking about this, it's there's two things that social media can do. One of them is kind of ironic. And the ironic one is it makes it a lot easier to make our little bubble, mm-hmm. our little echo chamber.
Yes.
Where you're only going to friend people who agree with you. If someone says something you don't like, you immediately unfriend. And I don't have to hear them, you know. It also has allowed all of our opinions to be published to the wide world, whether that's a good thing or not. You know, if you're sitting in a pub, or you're sitting in a restaurant, or you're sitting in a home, the only people who are going to hear you are those who are there. You know, there's not going to be a recording, hopefully, you know.
Unless you have an Alexa around. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You know, well, that's the other thing, too. You know, they've got these tools now that are recording us and stuff like that. But it's once it's said, it's there and gone, and it's only in memory. But now you post something on Facebook or Twitter or whatever, it's there almost permanently. It's kind of funny. You can delete it, but you can still find it. There's still ways to get at them, you know.
I did read this week that deleting tweets is now a thing. That people are going in and they're paying a service to go back and delete their early tweets. Like every couple of, you can delete like the first year or the second year or the last the 5 years.
The drunken because frat so boy many tweets.
Yes. Because when Twitter first came out, people just spewed at the mouth and said everything they wanted to. And yep. And I remember this, I remember talking to somebody and saying, when did snark become an acceptable form of communication, professional form of communication? Yeah. And it's devolved since then. But now I see they're going back and deleting them. Because it was at the Disney director that got fired. It was the Guardians of the Galaxy, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And he got fired because of some tweets he made as part of a conversation that no one can piece together, because how do you piece together 4 million tweets into one conversation? So the, as a standalone, they're terrible, horrible, completely unacceptable, and he's being judged by something he did 5, 6, 8 years ago.
Exactly.
We have a Braves baseball player going through the same thing. He almost threw a no-hitter for us on Sunday. Meanwhile, while he was getting into the seventh inning-ish or so, someone dug through his tweets from when he was 18, 19 years old, maybe even younger than that.
And yeah, I think he was 17. 17.
Said some dumb stuff, right?
High school.
High school kid making – a high school boy making bad choices. Let's think
that never happened.
A high school boy making bad choices.
That never happened.
So now they're holding him to that. But now he's a mature man looking back and said, oh my gosh, I forgot I said that. That was so stupid and ignorant of me.
Yeah.
I look back at me and at 17, I probably said some really dumb stuff.
Yeah. I'm glad I didn't have Facebook or Twitter back then.
Me too.
I mean, I say enough dumb things now as an adult, much less.
Yeah.
I won't allow my teenagers on Twitter. That's one thing. I do not allow them to have a Twitter account. I do not like the atmosphere there. I did break down and allow them to get Snapchat as they turned, you know, a certain age. I did break down and allow them to get Snapchat.
Do you monitor what they post, or how do you manage that as a parent? I'm really curious.
I talk to them a lot. I monitor their Instagram. I'm fairly certain they don't have a Finstagram, the fake Instagram account.
Is that what it's called?
I do take their – well, not – okay, my 19-year-old who's in college, I don't take her phone anymore. Okay, she's an adult. She's got a lot. But it's my responsibility as a mother of a high schooler to teach her how to use social media appropriately. And so I do take her phone from time to time, and I will look through everything. And I do follow her on Snapchat, but usually what she's using it for is, and I've noticed this, she's doing snaps back and forth to people she knows. And for her, it's about following people she knows. And we've talked, I know she's brought to me, you know, a friend that quit softball, and she saw her using an illegal substance, and she brought it to me and said, what do I do about this? And I said, well, you know, you've got to be a friend to her, but I'm not going to let you go to her house, and you're not going to hang with her anymore. And she said, I know, I can't. I can't trust her. So I'm internally, I'm sitting there thinking, oh, thank goodness, you know, I've done something right that she's telling me this, and she knows it's wrong.
Oh, yeah.
But I look at the kids that come through our Life Team program and our EDGE program, and they're in this, and I don't know if their parents are monitoring anything. And so sometimes when we tell them things in that, it dawns on me, I've told my kids this for years, and now I'm telling a 16-year-old going to be confirmed, and she's acting like she's never heard it before.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, where's your mother?
And, you know, unfortunately, I think there are still a lot of parents, although most people who are parents of a teenager, they're of that age, well, our generation really, where there's some familiarity with this technology, but we didn't grow up with it.
True.
You know, so true. I think there's kind of a naivete on a lot of people's part that of what trouble people really can get in on social media. Maybe there's more awareness now than there's been, but it's still very much a missing for a lot of people, that recognition of what this technology can do for better or worse.
For the most part, the kids just want to communicate, and they don't call each other anymore. They don't. Mm-mm. They text 100% text or Snapchat. Everything is sent through that phone. And we do take the phone up at night. She'll be 16 next week. But we do take the phone up. We do look at it, like I say, but that's how they communicate. I remember getting the phone call, and you'd run to the phone, and no, Dad, it's for me. And he'd be like, your parents would pick it up. Are you still on the phone? Get off the phone. Yes,
yeah.
Sir.
Oh, yeah.
Or you'd pass notes extension. In class. You'd pass them between class or in class. And they don't
I
do
remember
that now.
Having to
phones.
Learn how to call people and not say, is so-and-so there? Hello, Mr. or Mrs. So-and-so. This is Sarah. May I please speak with? Because my parents are like, never say, is so-and-so there? That's rude.
And of course, that's what everybody does now, you know?
No, now but you just call the person directly. Like, the kids don't know what it's like to have to call and talk to the parents first, which was always like a gamble.
Oh,
man,
that's
you were
right.
So nervous.
Exactly.
Well, I often wonder, you know, the way I raise my children is not the way I know a lot of other people raise their children. So am I doing my children a service or a disservice by showing them a different way to live in this world? Right. And sometimes that makes me sit and think about it, just because it will be hard for them to interact with other college kids and adults later. But so far, my college student hasn't come back and said, you know, Mom, you did a terrible job. And she's rocking it. So that gives me a lot of comfort. But I look at my six-year-old and I go, okay, if the world changed so much between 1999 and today, how much more is the world going to change in the next 10 years?
Well, that's just it, you know. I mean, and that's one thing we've got to come to grips with is maybe not so much technology in its own has changed in the last 20 years, but what that technology can do.
And the way we use it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And it's only going to get worse, you know, and maybe, who knows, you know, hopefully things don't snowball even further. Because I do believe that a lot of the problems that we have with social media, of how people use it and the divisions it's caused, they come from this not having a good understanding of how to use it in a way that's respectful of others and respectful of yourself.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think you're doing the right thing by how you're kind of helping them learn good controls on it.
Social media is a tool by which we communicate. We still have to learn how to communicate in a proper way,
right?
In a respectful way. So
exactly. And it's just, you know, what, 5 years ago that people learned, yes, you can lose a job based off of what you posted on Facebook or Twitter or lose a job offer because of it.
I've had people email me from other states and say, hey, this guy works for you, and he was insulting and rude and engaged with me in a Facebook room and called me names, et cetera, and sent me screenshots. And, oh, thank goodness. When we did the investigation, we first took a look and did the investigation. They had the same name. They'd been in the same branch of service, and they were from the same state, but it wasn't the same person.
Right.
And I was just like, because I don't know what I would have done. But when I read the comments, I'm like, this guy crossed a line. Mm-hmm. And I can't see this guy who works in our office doing that. So that's not his personality. Do I just not know him? Does he have, you know, your work personality, your home personality? But thankfully, it wasn't him. But I don't know what I would have done if it had been. So
very good. Yeah, that's a lot of companies are dealing with that. And sometimes they react well and sometimes they don't. So
another reason to log off.
Exactly. And this is a good point to log off this discussion. No, take a break here and just thank you for listening to Let's Talk. It's one of the podcasts here on SQPN that we're getting going again. We're getting things moving. Of course, we've got other podcasts that we're either restarting or starting new. We've got, of course, we got this one. We've got Secrets of Doctor Who that I've been doing with Dom Bettinelli and Jimmy Akin for a while. We've got Dom, Jimmy, and I are also getting restarting a Star Trek, Secrets of Star Trek here very shortly. We've already recorded the first couple of episodes, and those will be released here in the next couple of months. What else do we have here? We've got the Pilgrim Life, talking about doing a pilgrimage in Spain. It very much be worth listening to, checking it out. Secrets of Movies and TV Show. We've done shows with that, and we've had a lot of fun with that. Talk about different shows. The Indiana Jones. We've started some of the Indiana Jones movies, and we're going to get ready to talk about Temple of Doom here in a little while. We did Raiders of the Lost Ark uh, about a month or so ago, and we're going to do Temple of Doom here shortly. So lots of good options for us to that we're doing. So come check us out at sqpn.com and let us know what you think. And if you've got ideas for things to talk about, let us know as well. You can leave feedback for us here on Let's Talk at feedback at we've got a different email address. I keep wanting to use that, but that's not what I was doing.
It's a new email address, so forgive us.
Let's Talk, letstalk@sqpn.com. So don't put an apostrophe in there. The email won't go through. It's just letstalk@sqpn.com.
Yeah, think bad grammar.
Yeah, exactly.
Texting language.
Pretty much. So, all right. So kind of talking about that, talking about the social media, one of the things that blew up this week in social media is that the Pope changed the catechism. It's terrible. I know. The catechism has always had, from when John Paul II promulgated the catechism in the 90s, it's had a section on the death penalty. And it's always taken kind of a cautious approach to the death penalty, where when you look at the catechism, it says that the death penalty is something that is an option that is available in necessity. You know, governments have always had the ability to use the death penalty when it's justified. However, John Paul II added, and actually in the second edition of the catechism, he made it stronger, that it should only be used as a last resort. That if there are other non-lethal ways of securing the person for the rest of their life so that they can't harm someone else, that it should be used. You know, so of course the example you could think of is somebody like a serial killer, a notorious gang leader, mobster, something like that, where if they can be put away and not have access to the outside world and not hurt anyone, then they should. But if they can, you know, you can think of like a gang leader, a mobster, where if they can somehow still control their organization and cause more people to be harmed or killed, that maybe this should be considered. So Pope Francis this week changed that paragraph that gives that caution, and he made it a little bit stronger. The original paragraph written by, or at least promulgated by John Paul II, assuming that the guilty party's identity and responsibility have been fully determined, traditional teaching of the church does not exclude recourse to the death penalty, if this is the only possible way of effectively defending human life against the unjust aggressor. If, however, non-lethal means are sufficient to defend and protect people's safety from the aggressor, authority will limit itself to such means, as these are more in keeping with the concrete conditions of the human good and more in conformity with the dignity of the human person. Today, in fact, as a consequence of the possibilities which the state has for effectively preventing crime by rendering one who has committed an offense incapable of doing harm without definitively taking away from him the possibility of redeeming himself, cases in which the execution of the offender is an absolute necessity are very rare, if not practically non-existent. And that last bit was a quote from John Paul II from Evangelium Vitae, the Gospel of Life, one of his beautiful documents. I love John Paul II's writings. He's not a concise writer, but he's a beautiful writer. Pope Francis promulgated the change for the same paragraph, paragraph 2267. Recourse to the death penalty on the part of legitimate authority following a fair trial was long considered an appropriate response to the gravity of certain crimes, an acceptable, albeit extreme, means of safeguarding the common good. Today, however, there's an increasing awareness that the dignity of the person is not lost even after the commission of very serious crimes. In addition, a new understanding has emerged, the significance of penal actions imposed by the state. Lastly, more effective systems of detention have been developed, which ensure due protection of citizens, but at the same time do not definitively deprive the guilty of the possibility of redemption. Consequently, the Church teaches in light of the gospel that the death penalty is inadmissible because it is an attack on the inviolability and dignity of the person, and she works with determination for its abolition worldwide. So that's a lot of stuff. What do you think? What do you think, Sarah?
It just makes sense to me. I guess because I've studied theology and I do really try to live within the Catholic faith. It just makes sense to me. And I felt like while to many, maybe to those that aren't Catholic or the way that the media wants to spin it, that this is like new information. But to me, mm-hmm. rather, it just seems like the way that we as Catholics should have been living even after JP2's changes, right? Because mm-hmm. he made those changes in a time where the jails could handle and have an appropriate place to put somebody who would not right. be able to be dealt with well previously. So, you know, if someone mm-hmm. really is super dangerous in that they're going to continue killing all the guards that they're around, you know, there right. are places now that there are special prisons here, especially in the United States. I guess I can only speak on behalf of the United States. I should, right. you know, flag that. I don't know what the penal systems are like in other places around the world, but at least here in America, like, it's just seems like a natural update. So mm-hmm. because for me, you know, I've never been a huge fan of the death penalty, maybe for different reasons in my mind of how I justify it of, hey, I'd actually rather this person think about what they did for their whole life versus,
yeah.
you know, killing them, which I just don't think is appropriate anyway. But at the same time, it's like, and it's also, it costs more for the government, all this other stuff, right? There's so many reasons not to put someone to death besides the fact that why does the government have the right to kill anybody? That's, you know, whatever. But it just makes sense. To me, it just makes sense. And it doesn't seem like a massive shift, in my opinion. When it came out this week, I said, oh, okay, that makes yeah. sense.
Exactly. How about you, Shelley?
For me, let me preface it by saying that I live in Texas.
Yeah.
So I've been raised my whole life with the death penalty. Mm-hmm. When I went to college, I went to college in Huntsville, Texas, which is where it's where they do the executions. I lived in a dorm that was maybe 6 blocks away from the walls unit, which is where that takes place. So I can't really say that I'd ever thought anything different than, okay, it exists. And I think Texans are very proud that they have it. When I heard about the change in the catechism, my first thought was, can he do that? I didn't know that the popes could promulgate because I have not studied theology like you, Sarah, or like you, Father. So for me, being just the layperson, I was surprised he could actually change the catechism. I didn't know if it was just a word change or if it was a big C change. As I listened the first time, and you saying it, Father, was the second time I've heard it read out loud or read to me, it doesn't sound like an egregious shift in language. It sounds very much in line with what I expected the church's teachings to be, which is life comes first and we should always defer to life. I can argue both sides of it, but when I argue in my mind from the pro-death penalty side, it sounds more like rendering unto Caesar what is Caesar's versus what does Christ teach us about love and life. So, I mean, I could go either way on this discussion.
Right.
No, but I'm going to stay by what I said first.
Yeah.
And I will say that I live in Georgia where we also have the death penalty and actively do utilize it.
Right. Montana's the same way, although we don't have as, it's not as frequently here as it might be in some more populated place like Texas or Georgia. But it is very much used here as well. One thing I mentioned, this kind of blew up on social media because unfortunately, you know, again, we talked about social media polarizing people, and you either have, well, the Pope is a heretic for doing this, or the Pope is a living saint and we should canonize him now for doing this, you know, and the fact is the truth is in the middle. This really, first of all, when you look at the catechism is not an infallible document. And it even says in the catechism, I was trying to find it right now. I couldn't find the exact quote from the letter that John Paul II wrote when he promulgated the catechism. But basically, the catechism is a sure guide to helping us understand the teachings. You know, the catechism itself can be wrong. It's not. I don't believe it is. And I don't believe this change makes it wrong. But in itself, we are not bound as Catholics to absolutely, you must follow every word the catechism says. Mm-hmm. We are bound to follow the teachings that the catechism espouses. And we are also, even if it's not a definitive teaching, like the teaching, this teaching on the death penalty, we are still bound to give assent to it, which means we are bound to at least give it its due reverence, its due respect. You know, so we need to think about it. We can't just say yes or no and leave it at that. We need to make sure that we're giving at least a thought about it and consideration to what it has to say. One of the arguments, I kind of laugh because one of the arguments I heard is, well, this is just Francis in putting his opinion into the catechism. Well, you could argue that John Paul II inserted his opinion into the catechism by adding the paragraph in the first place, or having the paragraph inputted in the first place. And no one says that, or at least no one, you know, that who's not off their rocker. No, that would shoot their argument. This whole paragraph is pretty much the opinion of whoever was the Pope that modified it. But I agree, it's not a huge change. I think it's, I don't know if I'm the biggest fan of the language that Pope Francis is using here, or whoever wrote it for him. I don't know if he himself wrote it or if it was someone else. You know, a lot of times the popes don't write documents that they then release under their name, you know, but it's often their thought. But I don't see it as a bad deal, because it's still, the catechism still says, when you look in the previous paragraph, this is still an option. This is something that states can use. Pope Francis is just saying they shouldn't be using it. They can use it, but they shouldn't be.
See, and there's nothing wrong with that, in my opinion. We should think very hard before we go to such an extreme measure.
Mm-hmm.
And so if there is a way, like you said earlier, to lock someone up, and if the law doesn't allow for, I don't think Texas has life without parole. And so it's used.
Oh,
I know there's very strict questions. My sister is an attorney. So we've had many discussions about the death penalty as Catholics before.
Sure.
And it's one of those things you struggle with, you know. So my husband actually asked me, he's a Methodist who's about to enter our CIA, I think. I know. I could talk for an hour on just that. But he asked me, he says, if I don't agree with this, he says, does that mean I can't become a Catholic? And I said, no. I said, it means that you have, you know, something to sit and think about, something to sit and pray about. And, right. You know, God, I don't understand. Help me, lead me to an understanding and acceptance of what mm-hmm. your will is versus what the world I live in is.
Right.
And he was like, I think I can do that. I said, okay, here we go. Okay. So.
Yeah. And, you know, that's one thing in my life is my position on the death penalty has changed. And part of it is, you know, John Paul II's call to abolish it. I remember when I was, this was before I was in the seminary, I lived in the St. Louis area. And John Paul II was coming to visit during the Jubilee year, you know, big deal. And he was going to come and, you know, have all these talks and everything. And at the time there was a person who was on death row whose execution was coming up. It was shortly after John Paul II would be here. And he, while he was here in the United States, while he was in St. Louis, called the governor by name and said, do not do this, you know, do not end this death penalty, you know, commit his sentence. Don't, you know, give him life without parole, give him an option that he can live. And of course the governor didn't. And the person was executed about 2 months later, sadly. But that, it was just that what John Paul II was calling us to really changed my mind. Cause I was supportive of the death penalty when I was much younger, you know, and for much of the same reasons everybody always does. You know, these are dangerous people. They're without remorse. You know, everybody uses like the Ted Bundy example and, you know, the real extreme cases, but you don't hear the person who gets it when there's questionable circumstances about their conviction, when there's, you know, later a DNA screen finds out that they didn't do it, that they were truly innocent. You don't hear about those cases. You hear about the hard cases where you could make a justification for this. But they're very rare. Those cases are extremely rare.
And you said something just a minute ago. I think our perspective changes as we age, mm-hmm. as we mm-hmm. walk this journey of our own personal faith and our own relationship with Christ, that we look more towards an ideal. It's good to have an ideal because we all start somewhere and we all have to learn. And so it's very easy when you're raised in one way to say, I believe in the death penalty or I believe in this law. But the church is global. The church is universal. We're talking about the whole world. And the whole world doesn't have the same law as mm-hmm. we do in this town or you do in your state or you do in your rural state. And so there should be some common ideal that we look up to, we should aspire to. But, you know, my thoughts have changed even as I've matured and grown and had my children and watched the news and watched the world evolve.
So
I wish I had done some research on what might have driven this change, because surely it can't be a United States of America driven idea. Maybe there's something that happened in Argentina when Pope Francis was growing up, or mm-hmm. he's gotten word of something in another part of the world. So that's, I'm just kicking myself. I wish that I could have brought some perspective from some other cultures.
Well, one thing is, there was recently, the anniversary of the promulgation of the catechism in, you know, so it was 97. So there's an anniversary that came up and there was, and he kind of talked about this issue among others. There's a letter that you can go and read where it's discussed further, from the CDF that discusses further about why this was done.
Okay.
So it's on the Vatican website. It's actually still on the front page, the news section. So you can actually find it, unlike some things on the Vatican website.
Yes.
But so anyways, I think that's a good place to kind of leave off this discussion for the sake of time. And so we'll go on to our picks of the week. Sarah, why don't you start out here with our picks?
So I have two that are really one. Anyway, so one of my friends from college is taking her final vows of profession today for becoming a forever nun.
Awesome.
So vocations. Also, I would love to acknowledge that today is the feast of St. John Vianney, patron yes. of priests. So thank you, Father Corey, for the gift of your priesthood. So, you know, my pick of the week, which seems lame, but it's not, I promise, vocations, whether it's to priesthood or to religious life. Just, it's a beautiful thing, and these folks are just such a gift, and their life is a gift, and we should honor and pray for them constantly.
Oh, wonderful. And thank you, and thanks be to God for our vocations. Shelley, what do you have for us?
Well, I have to follow Sarah there. Oh, my goodness.
Sorry.
I have so many thoughts that go through my head. You said pick of the week. And the first thing that popped into my head was this book that I've been trying to finish because the TV movie's about to come out.
Uh-oh.
But I've really enjoyed it. It's been a while since I've had a book that really captured my spirit and just really enjoyed it. It's The Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society by Marianne Schaffer and Annie Barrows. I don't know if you've read it, Sarah, but
no, but we gotta put a link to that because I'm in.
So I don't have a lot of time to read, but I do have a long commute, and I do a lot of things by audio. So
Audible
I've been listening
is the
to the
best.
Yes, I've been listening to audiobook, and I got it from us from our library, but it's been streaming, and it's read by different actors' voices. So the whole book almost sounds like a radio show.
Cool, that's fun.
But it's a story about Juliet, and it's 1946. She's a single woman in her early 30s. She's an orphan, and she is just finishing up a book tour about I forget what it's called. I think it's Izzy Goes to War. It's these little short articles that she published in the newspaper, and they've bound them together and made them into a book. So it's post-World War II, during the recovery period, and she, I forget how, I think the initial letter, it's all told through letters. And She finds out about this island, the Channel Islands, Guernsey, which I've never looked up Guernsey. So it made me look up Guernsey. And she, through a series of letter exchanging letters, we learn about the occupation of Guernsey by the Germans. It's the only part of England that was occupied, I understand. And the people there and how reading and books contributed to their survival during the occupation. And it's just been delightful. And I know it's going to be advertised as this big love story, but it's a people story. It's a real good-hearted feeling. Family isn't who you're born to. Family is who you bring into your life.
What's it called again?
The Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society.
Okay.
Guernsey, Guernsey.
I'm looking it up right now on Audible, so thanks.
Okay, you're welcome. Yeah.
Hey, it is on Audible. It's got a really cool cover, and apparently it's going to be a Netflix film if it's not already. So
it comes out August 10th. I'm waiting. Can
you
tell?
Oh, man, I can't get through this in 6 days. That's okay, though. That's okay.
You can. It's an easy read, but listen to the book. The book is better. I mean, the audio is book better.
I have to admit, being in Montana, when I hear the name Guernsey, I think cow. And there's a breed of cow that comes from
that Guernsey,
island.
The Channel Islands. Yes.
Okay. Well, I just bought it on Audible, so there we go.
Nice. Unfortunately, we don't have Audible as a advertiser yet. Hint, hint. Audible. No. We will promote you.
Well, Sarah, make sure you've got the one that's read by Paul Bamer, Susan Dwerden, Rosalind Lander, John Lee, and Juliette Mills.
I will. I will have to make sure.
Yep. So, well, excellent. And my pick of the week is what I was doing last night, and that's going to the county fair. You know, living in a rural area, county fairs are still big deals. You know, there's still social events. There's still where the activities happen, concerts and so on. Last night we had a concert by a group, Roots and Boots, or Boots and Roots. One of those ways. It's either Roots and Boots or Boots and Roots. But it's Sammy Kershaw, Aaron Tippin, and Colin Ray. Colin Ray, by the way, being a very devout Catholic. And it was a lot of fun. You know, it was a great concert. But just the whole fair environment is, in these rural areas, it's still the thing to do. And I know in bigger, more populated areas, they still have county fairs. And they're much bigger deals, you know, much, much more rides, much more activities, events. But you can still go through and see the different exhibits that people put up, the things that people put in for judging, you know, the vegetable judging and the art judging and all that. So it's very much worth doing. It's one of those things here in the United States that really kind of harkens back to a simpler time and harkens back to a time when your local community was important. Your mm-hmm. county was important. And you didn't have social media to keep you busy and occupied all the time. But there are other things out there to see and do. And of course, you know, in small town America here, you know, you've got the farm animals and all the different exhibits. So definitely if it's county fair season in many places. So if you get a chance to go check that out, even in the big cities, it's very much worth checking out. So, well, that does it for this week. Thank you again for listening. You know, thank you, Shelley and Sarah, for being here. Shelley, why don't you tell where people can find you?
Well, not that Sarah will find me because she quit Facebook, but primarily we're on Facebook.
Sorry.
That's fine. On Facebook, it's Of Sound Mind and Spirit, which is also the name of a blog I keep with my sister. And I'm on Instagram also. I think I'm Shelley SMAS for Sound Mind and Spirit on Instagram. And I'm public there, so you can catch pictures of different things I'm doing, either softball, baseball, or catechesis. So,
good stuff. And you, Sarah, where can people find you?
You can sometimes find me on Twitter at Catholic Drinky. You can find me on my podcast with Tommy Tai, the Catholic Hipster Podcast, which we're on a break right now, but we'll be back in September. And you can find me on Instagram at Catholic Drinky, or you can just find me on an airplane.
In an airport somewhere.
That would be fun. Where in the world is Sarah Fabulous?
Yeah. Anybody want to go to England with me next week?
Me?
Let's go.
I'll go.
Road trip or flight.
I just have to arrange a few things.
Perfect. See you there.
That'd be awesome. Be awesome. Again, I'm Father Corey Stika. You can find me on Facebook mostly at Father Corey Stika. That's my public page. That's probably the easiest place to find me. My website where I post my homilies is frcory.org. And of course, you can find me in Montana if you want to come to my parish and mass and all that good stuff. So, again, let us know what you think. Send us your feedback. We want to hear from you as well, because this isn't just us talking. We want to hear what you have to say. We especially like audio feedback. If you want to send that, we can put that in, we can play that and add that to the show. It's Let's Talk, L-E-T-S Talk at sqpn.com. Thank you again for joining us, and God bless.